So good evening, everybody. I hope that everyone is well. We started last week on our segment on biblical interpretation. We introduced the somewhat awkward word exegesis. I once tried to explain to somebody why the term exegesis doesn't apply to Christians who convert to Judaism. It's just simply an anglicization of a Greek word that means interpretation. And therefore, perhaps it might even just be better if we use the Hebrew word parshanot. So last week, we took a global view of biblical interpretation. And we will begin this evening with a series of somewhat more focused looks at individual parshanim, individual biblical exegetes. And this evening, we're going to look at the origins of biblical interpretation in the Talmud. And we will go into the near post-Talmudic period, the era that went from about the 8th till the 11th century, the era that is known as the era of the Geonim. And the thread that we will try to follow continuously throughout all of these focused looks at parshanim, at exegetes, will be the quest for pshat. And therefore, the first thing that we're going to do is define the terms. Generally speaking, the history of biblical interpretation can be divided in two, not chronologically, but it can be divided into two thematically. There are those biblical exegetes, those parshanim, who gloried in the pursuit of what they called peshat, while there were others, and I'll just move up one slide and then go back again, while there were others who pursued what they called the Durash. So basically, the two poles of biblical interpretation are Peshat and Durash. They really aren't opposite poles, although they are more often than not. Occasionally, one can actually find a Peshat of a biblical verse that actually derives from a Durash. Exactly how that happens is what we're going to discover over the coming weeks. But first, back to the dictionary definitions of Peshat and Durash. These definitions are taken from the perhaps the best known biblical Hebrew dictionary. It's called BDB after its editors, Brown, Driver, and Briggs. And here you see the entry for the verb peshintet. Right? In case you didn't know it was a verb, you can see right following it the letters VB, which is the abbreviation for verb. And it means to strip something off, to remove a covering, or it could mean to make a dash or a raid. And you can see some of the different nuances, right? From stripping something off, you can get the idea of stretching something out, to extending it. Basically, if we tried to apply this to biblical interpretation, the impression that we get, at least on the surface, see, and that's the key word, surface, because if peshat means to remove something, to remove a covering, then it means to remove the surface. So in essence, it's basically the removal of the surface. The question is, are you removing the surface because that is your objective? In which case, the pshat of a biblical verse is its superficial meaning, or are you removing the superficial meaning in order to provide a glimpse at something that is more profound? And that, too, as I said, is a question that we will see addressed over the coming weeks. But then again, just to simplify it, pshat refers to the surface level of a biblical text, that which is visible to the reader. And that is distinct from the Durash, which, as you see, as a verb, means to resort to seek, right? Or if you look towards the end of the second line, to read repeatedly or to study. And you can see again on the fourth line, NH, New Hebrew, it means to search out a meaning or to expound, to interpret, to explain. Okay. So if the Peshat relates to the surface meaning of a text, the Darash clearly refers to a meaning that lies deeper within the text and that has to be uncovered. Okay. The first use that we find of this term, where it is clearly being used to address a method of biblical interpretation, is in the Talmud, in the Gemara in Masechet Shabbat, beginning with the following Mishnah. Lo yetze ha'ish, lo b'sayef, lo b'keshet, lo b'tris, lo be'ala, v'lo v'romach. All those are the names of weapons with which soldiers used to be equipped. And the Mishnah is saying that it is prohibited for somebody to go out on Shabbat carrying one of these weapons. V'im yatza, and if indeed somebody negligently went out of doors while carrying one of these weapons, chayav chatat, then he has violated, he has transgressed one of the laws of Shabbat, and he has to bring a sacrifice. So clearly the position of the Mishnah is that weapons of war cannot be carried on Shabbat. Okay. However, the Mishnah continues, and Rabbi Eliezer disagrees with the first position in the Mishnah. Rabbi Eliezer says, Tachshitin hein lo. Rabbi Eliezer says it is permissible to carry weapons because the weapons are ornamental. V'chachamim omrim, to which the sages reply somewhat in disdain. And they say to Rabbi Eliezer, what are you talking about? How can weapons of war be ornamental? Einan ela lignai. They're actually shameful. Shene Emar, and they cite the famous verse that, as you all know, comes from the book of Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza, right? The Isaiah wall. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. So clearly, if the swords and the spears have to be recycled into agricultural implements, then say the rabbis, it's clear that they serve no ornamental purpose. And therefore, once they're not going to be used for the military purpose for which they were designed, they serve no purpose whatsoever. This is simply the background to the following passage in the Talmudic discussion of this Mishnah. The Talmud asks, in its typical rhetorical fashion, Maitama de Rabbi Eliezer de Amar Tachshitin Hemo. Since everybody knows the verse that was cited by the sages, the one that says that weapons of war are shameful, what support does Rabbi Eliezer have for his contrary position, the one that regards weapons as being ornamental? And the Talmud replies by citing a verse in the book of Tehillim, Chagor Charbecha al Yarech Gibor, addressing a gibor, a soldier, a man of war. The book of Tehillim says to him, gird your sword about your waist, hodecha vahadarecha. It is your pride and joy. So we see that at least one biblical verse, weapons of war are referred to as a pride and joy, or in other words, they could indeed be ornamental. But this interpretation of the verse in Tehillim is troubling to Rabbi Kahana. And Rabbi Kahana takes exception to this reading of the verse in Tehillim, And he says to one of his colleagues, Hai b'divrei Torah ketiv. Everybody knows that that verse in Psalms is not meant to be taken literally, as though it were referring to a soldier and to his weapons. Rather, he maintains that everybody knows that that verse is understood figuratively, that the gibor is not a soldier, but it's a scholar, a Torah sage, and the weapons of a Torah sage are his wits. So how can that serve as a proof text for Rabbi Eliezer when it isn't really talking about an actual sword and an actual soldier? And the answer that Mar Brei de Rav Huna gives to his colleague is, Ein mikra yotze midei pishuto. No biblical verse can be purged of its literal sense or of its plain meaning. Just to understand the phrase, mikra, as we already know, right, is simply the Mishnaic and Talmudic Hebrew way to refer to the Bible. Remember again that likro in biblical Hebrew and in Mishnaic, in rabbinic Hebrew as well, doesn't mean to sight read. It means to read aloud. And therefore, the quintessential text that would be read aloud would be the text of the Torah. So Mikra is a reference to a scriptural text. Now, Latzeit Yedei is a not uncommon Hebrew expression. You find it most commonly used when somebody wants to know if he has fulfilled a religious obligation. The word for obligation is chova, and to say that you have fulfilled a religious obligation, the expression is latzeit yedei chova. I should add parenthetically that very often amongst young people, or often in circles of people who are somewhat new to the practice, to the rigorous practice of Judaism, you'll hear them say this in an abbreviated fashion. Instead of saying, was I yotze yedei chova, you'll hear them simply say, was I yotze? Okay. Now, what are they asking when they want to know if they were yotze yedei chova? You have to use your imagination. And you have to imagination that chova, that obligation, actually has a pair of hands, yadayim, and that these hands, the hands of obligation, will hold on to you until you meet your obligation. Once you meet your obligation, then obligation will relinquish its hold on you. So if you say, was I yotze yedei chova, you want to know whether you have met your obligation and whether obligation then will relinquish its hold on you. Now let's apply this now to this Talmudic statement. It says that Mikra, a biblical verse, yotze midei, gets out of the grasp of what? Of its pshat. So it says no biblical verse ever gets out of the grasp of its pshat. Now, all it means for us to do is we have to understand what is the pshat of the verse. Well, I think it's pretty clear. In the first three lines, we saw the verse itself. And the verse itself, read simply, is referring to an actual sword and an actual soldier. Okay? That would be the pshat of the verse, what you see on the surface. Okay? Then Rabbi Kahana came along and said, no. It's not a real soldier. It's a euphemism for a Torah scholar. And a Torah scholar doesn't wage war with a sword. A Torah scholar wages war, so to speak, with his knowledge of Torah. That then would be the drash of that verse. It doesn't mean that it's wrong. It doesn't mean that it's not what the verse means at all. It only means that that's not what meets the eye. So clearly, the pshat of a verse is what meets the eye. Okay? Therefore, what Marbrei de Rav Huna is saying when he says, Ein mikra yotze midei pshuto, is that even if on occasion we will prefer the drash, we will prefer to interpret a verse in a manner other than the one that meets the eye, you can never totally dismiss that surface meaning. So, as you see, I prefer to translate it as a verse cannot be purged of its plain meaning, or if you wish, of its literal sense. This phrase, Ein mikra yotze midei pshuto, appears only three times in the entire Babylonian Talmud. Does it appear only three times because people in the time of the Talmud were really uninterested in biblical interpretation and therefore it only arose in discussion three times? That's a possibility. Another possibility is that it was so well known that it didn't have to be stated. So let me take you into one of the other two places in the Talmud where this phrase appears. It appears in the tractate Yevamot, which is a discussion of what in English is called leveret marriage. L-E-V-I-R-A-T-E. Leveret is simply Latin for a brother-in-law. And the Torah dictates that if a person dies and a married person dies childless, then there is an obligation on the brother of the deceased to marry the widow. And then it says in the second verse, Vaya b'chor asher teled, that the firstborn child of the marriage between the widow and her brother-in-law, Yakum al shem achiv hamet, will rise up, so to speak, in the name of the deceased brother. Why? V'lo yimachesh shemo miYisrael, so that his name is not erased from the Jewish community. So apropos of this verse, the Talmud says as follows. The rabbis learned, Vaya b'chor asher teled yakum al shem achiv hamet. What is the meaning of the verse? That the firstborn child of this marriage shall rise or succeed in the name of the deceased of the deceased brother. The rabbis say it means l'nachala. It means that the firstborn child of this marriage becomes the legal heir of the deceased brother. Hold on, says the Talmud. Are you sure that it means in respect of inheritance? Maybe it literally means in respect of the name. After all, the verse says, Yakum al shem achiv hamet. What would that mean? It would mean that if the deceased's name was Joseph, then the child should be named Joseph. If the deceased was named Yohanan, then the child should be named Yohanan. After all, as I said, what meets the eye, so to speak, when I read this verse? The word shame, which ordinarily means someone's name. Therefore, the Talmud has to come up with another interpretation of the word shame, which it does by citing a verse that we read only a couple of weeks ago at the very end of the book of Bereshit. When Jacob gives a blessing to Joseph's two oldest sons, Ephraim and Menashe, he says that he will take Ephraim and Menashe into his family, so to speak, and he will treat them just as he treats his other children. However, any other children that Joseph has have to share in the inheritance of their two older brothers. And the verse that Jacob uses to describe that situation is, Al shem acheihem yikareu benachalatam. Literally, they will be called after the names of their brothers in matters of inheritance. Therefore, the Talmud says that since in the case of Jacob and Joseph, the word shame is used in reference to inheritance, so it is in reference to the marriage between the widow and the brother-in-law, that when it says that the firstborn child shall bear the name of the deceased, It means that it will be he will be the deceased's legal heir. To which the very important 4th century Amora Rava comes along and says, Af al gav de b'chol ha-Torah kula ein mikra yotzei midei pshuto, even though universally we usually have a rule that you cannot purge a text of its literal sense, in which case the verse that says that the firstborn child shall bear the name of the deceased should be taken literally. Hacha, he says, in this case, we make an exception to the rule because of something called a gezerah shava, which I've translated here as a lexical analogy. An analogy, of course, is a comparison between two things. Lexicon refers to a dictionary. A lexical analogy is where you basically introduce a homonym. You say, yes, if I were to look up the word shame in a Hebrew dictionary, it would have two entries. The first entry would say shame means a name. But there would be a second entry under the noun shame, and it would say inheritance. The dictionary might tell me that the first entry accounts for 99.6% of all of the cases of the word shame, and the second accounts for only 0.04% of those cases. But essentially, it's telling me that the word shame always had two meanings. It's just that one of the two meanings was so prevalent, so predominant, as to have eclipsed the other. But for our purposes, it's sufficient to simply appreciate that we've seen two out of the three instances in which the Talmud provides us with what will become a very important rule in the interpretation of Tanakh, namely that even if I will prefer to dig deeper into a biblical verse, I can never entirely dismiss or deny that meaning of the words that meets the eye. Now, what do we know about the study of Tanakh by the authors of the Talmud or in the near centuries following the completion of the Talmud? The Talmud was completed somewhere at the beginning of the 5th century, okay? So what we have very little evidence between the 5th and the 8th centuries, almost no literary evidence even, and certainly little, if any, documentary or historical evidence. But what we do have is a responsum from the 9th century, from Rabbi Natronai Gaon. The word Gaon would best translate into modern English as the dean. At any given point in time, from the 8th century through the 12th century, the person who was the dean of one of the two leading yeshivot or academies in Babylonia was called the Gaon. So it was a title that, at least in those days, was reserved only for one or two people in each generation. I frequently have to remind my students that we are not living in the Gaonic age, even though nowadays it seems to be de rigueur that as soon as somebody gets smicha and becomes a rabbi, people refer to him as a Gaon. But at least during the genuine Gaonic period, only two people at any time ever bore that title. So at one point in the 9th century, Rabbi Natronai was one of those two people. And he wrote a very interesting responsum. And in the course of answering a question of halacha, he makes an historical observation. And this is the observation that he makes. He said that following the Shacharit prayer in a synagogue, people would stay around. They didn't just run out. They would stay in the synagogue and they would study Torah. Study Torah means that they would study a religious text. He says there were some who studied Mishnah. There were others who studied Talmud, okay? And there were yet others who studied Mikra. And in fact, this is he calls it fulfillment of the advice of the sages. This actually is a Talmudic prescription. It's in the Talmud in Masechet Kiddushin. It says that a person should divide his leisure study time into three parts, three equal parts, one for Tanakh, one for Mishnah, and one for Gemara. Okay? But now he says as follows in the second paragraph. He says that there was a point where there was a crisis, when poverty overwhelmed the world and scholars were forced to earn a living. They were unable to do their thirds daily. The historical estimation is that he's talking about a time in the 8th century, the time roughly of the Muslim conquest of Persia, right? What we call the Babylonian Talmud, right? The word Babylonia really makes no sense in the Middle Ages. There were no Babylonians anymore. By the time that the Talmud was written, the land that had been Babylonia in the biblical period was already part of the Persian Empire. Okay? So in the 8th century, Persia was conquered by the Muslims, by the Arabs. And one of the things that Muslims did when they conquered territory was that they reserved the ownership of land for Muslims. Okay? Anybody who has studied the Babylonian Talmud knows that the typical occupation of a Jew during the time of the Babylonian Talmud was agriculture. So the Muslim conquest of Persia turned Jewish society in Persia upside down, because the only way that they could continue to own land and to practice agriculture was by converting to Islam. And while surely there were some Jews who did, as there were Christians and Zoroastrians as well, most Jews refused to. And it's at that point in time that Jews abandoned agriculture and they moved to the cities, particularly to the capital city of Baghdad, which was built in the 9th century. And they began to practice the urban professions of commerce and banking. Now, if you know anything about farming, you know that farmers work very hard, but they can only work from sun up to sunset. And they can only work during those months of the years in which agriculture is useful. So it means that farmers have time every day in which they don't work. And there are months every year in which they don't work, which means that farmers have more leisure time for study than do merchants or bankers. Therefore, what Rabbi Natronai is saying is that when Jews were forced off the land and into the cities, and they were forced to earn a living, meaning they'd always earned a living, but now they had to spend more time at it, they didn't have the leisure time to study Mikra, Mishnah, and Gemara. What did they do instead? They decided that they would study the Talmud alone. Why of the three did they choose to study only the Talmud and not study Mikra and Mishnah? Because while in the Tanakh there is neither Mishnah nor Gemara, and while there is some Tanakh in the Mishnah, there's no Gemara in it, in the Gemara there are elements of both Mikra and Mishnah. So what they did is they took a verse in the book of Kohelet, Kol hanechalim holechim el hayam, all of the rivers flow to the sea, and they said, Tanakh and Mishnah are rivers, the Talmud is a sea, and therefore they will spend their leisure study time on Gemara, on the Talmud. So this gives us an indication of why during the 8th, 9th, and even into the middle of the 10th century, there appears to have been no widespread engagement with the interpretation of Tanakh. All of that changes in the first half of the ninth century with the arrival of yet another Gaon, Saadia Gaon, who was born and grew up in Egypt and spent some time living in the land of Israel, but eventually became one of the deans of the two academies in Baghdad in Babylonia. Saadia became the first rabbinic scholar to compile a systematic and methodical commentary on the Bible, paying attention to both its legislative and narrative sections. That's simply to remind us that, of course, there's biblical interpretation in the Mishnah, and of course, there's biblical interpretation in the Talmud, but it is neither systematic nor methodical. Okay. What stimulated motivated Saadia Gaon to undertake this systematic and methodical interpretation of Tanakh, while, as we've seen in previous centuries, it was neglected? There were at least two external factors that we are aware of. One is the challenge that was presented to rabbinic Judaism by Islam, and the other is the challenge that was presented to rabbinic Judaism by Karaism. What is the challenge that was presented by Islam? We learn of that apropos of a fascinating little piece of information that was shared with us by Abraham Ibn Ezra, the 12th century Spanish Bible exegete, whom we will look at in much greater detail later on, who, again, is kind of like a sidebar to his commentary towards the beginning of the book of Bereshit, apropos of the pasuk that names one of the four rivers of paradise, one of the four rivers of Gan Eden, as Pishon. Ibn Ezra tells us that the Gaon, and whenever Ibn Ezra says the Gaon without giving a proper name, it is definitely Saadia. He says that Saadia identified the Pishon with the Nile. But he's quick to observe, Ein re'aya al Pishon shehu hayor. There is no objective proof or evidence that the Pishon was the Nile. Ki ein lo kabbalah. He says that in fact there is no unbroken tradition to that effect. We actually last week saw Ibn Ezra's use of the word kabbalah, remember, as opposed to sevara. So Ibn Ezra is saying that Saadia's identification of the Pishon as the Nile, right, is without support in Jewish tradition. And he goes further. And he says, V'chein asa b'mishpachot u'v'medinot u'v'chayot u'v'a'ofot u'v'avanim. He says, in the same way that Saadia offered a contemporary identification of the river Pishon, Saadia, in his Arabic translation of the Torah, offered contemporary equivalents of lots of things, of names of countries, names of animals, names of birds, names of minerals. And Ibn Ezra says about this entire enterprise, ulai b'chalom ra'am. He says that since none of these things can be supported by tradition, there's no objective proof for any of these identifications. It's kind of like he saw them in a dream, which is essentially saying that it was a sivara, that it was his personal opinion. Indeed, he goes so far to say, "Uchvar ta'ab b'miktzatam kasher afaresh bimkomo." He says, and indeed, I can show you in several cases that he's just wrong. In which case, says Ibn Ezra, "Lo nisha'en al chalomotav." We are not obliged to rely on Saadia's personal opinion. But then he says that you might question, right? So if Saadia didn't really know what all of these things were, why would he offer identifications of them? Why didn't he do what even modern translations often do, and that is transliterate them? You want to know what the Pishon is? Spell it, P-I-S-H-O-N, and move on. So Ibn Ezra says, "Ulai asachen lichvod Hashem." He says that he suspects that Saadia's intentions were noble. Why? Babur Shetirgem HaTorah Bilshon Yishmael Uvichtivatan. Because he tells us that Sa'adya undertook a translation of the Torah into Arabic, not only into the Arabic language, as Jews spoke it and read it and wrote it using the Hebrew alphabet, but that Sa'adya even saw to the rendition of his Arabic translation of the Torah into the Arabic script. Why? And here's the punchline. Shelo yomru ki yesh batorah mitzvot lo yida'anum. So that the Muslims will not be able to say that there are mitzvot in the Torah that we do not understand. And think about it. It's logical and reasonable. If Sa'adya were to say, Pishon, you got me. I mean, this was so long ago, nobody today knows what Pishon is. Okay, I can live with that. But then come along and take a word like totafot. Right? The biblical word for the tefillin shel rosh. Ukshatam la'ot al yadacha uletotafot b'neinecha. So if you come along and you say, Pishon, nobody knows what the Pishon is today, then how can you convince anybody that, oh yes, but I do know what totafot means. Therefore, in order to foster the impression that rabbinic Judaism knew the meaning of everything in the Torah, Sa'adya had to provide an identification of everything. And that, says Ibn Ezra, was at least a noble intention, even if in practice he got some things wrong. Here we have an actual citation from Sa'adya's introduction to his commentary on the Torah. And I'm not going to read it through with you. I just want you to look at the words that are highlighted in yellow. And if you have trouble reading them, it's because they're not Hebrew, they're Judaic. Is that the words that you see here on this page in Judeo-Arabic are technical terms in the interpretation of Holy Scripture, and that they were in use long before Sa'adya Gaon used them to interpret the Jewish Bible. Muslims were using the same terms, the same expressions to interpret the Arabic Quran. So the point that I simply want to make is that when Sa'adya Gaon set about the task of interpreting the Tanakh, he modeled his approach to the interpretation of Tanakh on the approach that some Muslims had taken to the interpretation of the Quran, even to the point of using the exact same terminology. But the point that he's making here is a very important point. The point that he's making here is that, and if you look at the fourth line from the top of the page, the raison d'etre of every book is to have its contents attained fully by its readers. Meaning, Sa'adya presumed that God's purpose in giving us the Bible was to give us something that we would understand. It surely would not serve any of God's purposes to give us a book that we couldn't read or understand properly. Therefore, says Sa'adya, since that understanding, that interpretation of the text, that is best known amongst the most people is the one that meets the eye, the literal one, the surface meaning, right? Therefore, says Sa'adya, that is basically what we today would call our default position. The default position of a biblical interpreter, says Sa'adya, is to start off with the assumption that what he is reading can be understood literally. However, he says, there are four conditions under which you have to set the literal sense aside and prefer something that is figurative or even metaphorical. And what are those four conditions? The four conditions, he says, and that's continuing here in the upper paragraph, unless, after the word unless, sense perception, that's one, meaning if the literal sense of a verse defies one of my five senses, then it's not meant to be literal. Rational knowledge, if it's just simply something I find illogical, okay? Or if the literal sense of two verses are contradictory, one of them can remain literal, but the other cannot. And the fourth condition, he says, is if the literal meaning of a verse contradicts a reliable, that he means a rabbinic tradition. And here are four examples. Here are four biblical verses. In each of these verses, there is one of those four problems that Saadia anticipated. And here's his discussion of them, but I'd rather go back and do it with you this way. It says that Adam named his wife Eve because she was the mother of all living things. Well, my own two eyes tell me that no human woman can be the mother of all living things. Therefore, says Saadia, this verse is clearly not intended to be understood literally. And what he does then is he interprets the word chai, not just as living in the sense that animals and insects are also living creatures, but he interprets it the way the Aramaic Targum understood the word chai, as a living, thinking, speaking being. And that is indeed a property that is unique to the female of the human species. Verse number two describes God as an all-consuming fire. Now, that is an example of something that is philosophically unacceptable. Why? Because fires are only temporary, whereas God is permanent. Fires are finite, while God is infinite. Right? You light a fire, it burns only as long as you fuel it. And once you run out of fuel, the fire is extinguished. Therefore, here too, it's not that God is an all-consuming fire, but there is an attribute of God, namely his exacting justice or vengeance, which can be compared to an all-consuming fire. The third example is actually an alternative to the second one. It's a more narrowly Jewish philosophical position. And that is that God says that his face cannot be seen because a person cannot see him and live to talk about it. I have to go back. The third verse and the fourth verse go together. On one hand, God says of himself that he is invisible, because if someone were to see him, he would die. And yet the Torah itself tells us that at the theophany, when God revealed himself to Moses and revealed the Ten Commandments to the Jewish people at Mount Sinai, it says that the elders of Israel, Vayir'u et Elohei Yisrael, they saw God. Well, one way or the other. Right? So this is an example of two verses that contradict each other. Either God cannot be seen or God can be seen. So the way Saadia and other exegetes resolved it is that, of course, the essence of God is invisible, but occasionally God will allow one of his attributes to be seen. The last example is the famous example of Ayin Tachat Ayin, which we will look at in a moment in greater detail, where the Torah seems to say literally an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, etc., etc., while the Talmud says that if you break somebody else's arm, you don't lose your arm, but you rather have to pay for it. If you knock out somebody's tooth, you don't lose one of your own, but rather you have to pay for it. Therefore, to Saadia, the fact that rabbinic tradition understands this verse in a figurative fashion is proof that this too was not meant to be taken literally. This is just simply his explanations of it, but we've cut through it. Here, as I said, is the example, just simply you can note it. If you're interested, it's again Ibn Ezra's commentary on the verse that first mentions ayin tachat ayin. And in this verse, Ibn Ezra gives us the transcript of what purports to be a dispute over the meaning of this verse that was held between a certain Karaite and Sa'adya Gaon. We're not really certain whether this is a dispute that actually transpired historically. We don't even really know whether it was a dispute that Sa'adya carried on with a Karaite literarily. We're also not even sure who this Karaite was and whether he might in fact have been a figment of Ibn Ezra's literary imagination, because the name that Ibn Ezra gives for him, you can see it in the second bullet point, is Ben Zuta. And what Ben Zuta means is the little guy, right? The one who doesn't amount to anything. So we're not even really certain, as I say, about whether this is the text of a genuine disputation, or whether it's one that Ibn Ezra manufactured on his own. One way or the other, if you look at the last bullet point and to the passage that's highlighted again in yellow, the rule is, says Sa'adya Gaon, we cannot interpret the Torah's commandments completely without relying upon the sages. Another one of the Gaonim who made very important fundamental contributions to the establishment of Parshanot HaMikra, biblical exegesis, was one of Sa'adya's successors in the academy that Sa'adya headed, the Academy of Sura, and that was a Gaon of the late 10th, early 11th century named Shmuel Bar Chofni. And he, in his introduction to his commentary on the Torah, mentioned several rules. As you can see, the first bullet point refers to something that he calls the third principle. And here we have the seventh principle and the ninth principle. Okay? I'd like to look at the ninth one with you briefly. The ninth matter means the principles of biblical interpretation, is that anything that is either indicated by a proof text, clarified by scripture, or established by rational proof, should be declared firmly and decisively. Meaning, if you've got biblical evidence for it, okay, or if you can prove it logically, then go with it. However, he says, those interpretations that the sages call midrashot or agadot, whatever speculation produces or the intellect yields regarding a verse that does not deal with the commandments, then what about that, says Shmuel Bar Chofni? He may embellish and adorn his speech with it, but he should declare it to be merely possible or straightforward. So you see, he begins to draw distinctions between things that I am obliged to accept because they are proven textually or rationally, as opposed to things that are merely speculative. Again, we saw this last week in Ibn Ezra when he drew that dichotomy between Kabbalah and Sivara. We can begin to see here in Sa'adya Gaon and in Shmuel Bar Chofni where Ibn Ezra might have come to this. And finally, he says this, and this is a rather sharp critique. He says, it is not permissible for us to believe the truth of something when there are proofs that it is false only because one of the early authorities said it. Meaning, if you come along, tell me that something is so because some rabbi said it. But on the other hand, I can prove to you either textually or rationally that that is not true. Then the fact that some rabbi may have said it does not compel me to accept it. Rather, he says, it's necessary to examine the matter rationally. Something that has proof indicating its necessity, means something that is axiomatic, right? Then we have to accept it because of the compulsion of reason. Whatever has proof of possibility as opposed to axiomatic, it's merely possible, then we will say, okay, it's possible. And whatever is indicated to be impossible, he says, then we have to come out and say, no way. And here's an example of it. His commentary is cited by Rabbi David Kimche, another one of the principal medieval parshanim, whom we'll look at later in greater detail. The 20th chapter of the first book of Samuel introduces us to the witch of Endor. You remember Endora, right, from Bewitched? So that's the origin of her name, the witch of Endor. And in his commentary, Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi, cites the approach of Rabbi Shmuel ben Chofni. And he quotes him as saying, Afalpi, Shemashma'ut divrei chachamim zal bagmara, even though it seems that the sages of the Talmud said, Ki emet haya shehechyita ha'isha et Shmuel, even if the rabbis of the Talmud seemed to be inclined to believe that the witch was actually able to conjure up the spirit of Samuel, Rabbi Shmuel ben Chofni said, Lo yukublu hadevarim, we cannot accept such an opinion, b'makom sheyesh makhishim lahem min haseichel, because it contradicts reason. So the lesson of the Talmud and of the initial attempts at biblical exegesis that were undertaken by the Gaonim is that we seek to understand, our default position is to assume that things can be understood literally. And of course, to understand something literally requires a very keen knowledge of the Hebrew language. And that is why we will see the important role that Hebrew grammar and philology play in the interpretation of the Bible. And in addition to the pursuit of Peshat as the visible surface meaning of the text, there is also the deference to reason and to logic. I want only to mention Rashi because we'll move on to Rashi next week very quickly in order to give you something to think about. This is what I want you to think about. This is Rashi's commentary towards the beginning of the book of Bereshit. Unlike Sa'adya Gaon and Shmuel ben Chofni, who wrote lengthy and detailed introductions to their Torah commentaries, Rashi didn't. Rather, strewn here and about throughout Rashi's actual interpretations of Tanakh are some descriptions of his own methodology. And this is the one that has always been regarded by scholars as the most important. It's contained in his commentary on Bereshit Perek Gimel Pasuk Chet, in which Rashi says that on the one hand, there are many agadic midrashim, such as those that have been arranged by the rabbis in Bereshit Rabbah and in other midrashic anthologies. On the other hand, there is what Rashi himself plans to do. And what does Rashi say that he plans to do as opposed to what the rabbis did? You can see the rabbis used midrash. Rashi says that he's going to focus on pshuto shel mikra. But then Rashi says that he's not dismissing Midrash and Agadah entirely, but Rashi says that there is a particular type of Agadah that he will use in his commentaries. He calls it an Agadah HaMiyashevet Divrei Mikra, an Agadah that will settle a difficult verse. But this is what I want you to think about. Rashi ends this comment, this observation on his own methodology, with four words, davar davur al ofnav, a word fitly spoken. These four words are half of a verse. The full verse, as you see, is in the 25th chapter of the book of Proverbs, verse 11. Anybody who'd like to see if they can anticipate what we're going to talk about, one of the things we will talk about Rashi next week, might want to look up the whole verse and figure out what does Rashi mean when he incorporated half of that verse into his commentary here at the beginning of Bereshit. And we will pick up again with Rashi when we resume next week. Let me then go to the chat. If Saadia was doing what Islamic scholars in his time, then Islam was having trouble understanding text earlier in its history than Judaism by many hundreds past. A thousand years before Saadia Gaon, there was no Islam. Saadia was born in 882. Muhammad died in 632. So Islam is not 1,000 years older than Judaism. But everybody has trouble with texts, especially if they believe those texts to be divinely revealed. It's much easier to try to understand a text that was written by a human being if you believe that the human being was uninspired in writing it, because then what you do is what literary critics and scholars have been doing for centuries. You determine what the author's intent was, and guided by the author's intent, you interpret the author's remarks. The problem intensifies when you say that the person who physically wrote the words down on paper was not writing his own words, but was either writing words that were dictated to him by God, or at the very least was writing words that God had inspired him to write. Because then you're not only trying to understand the intentions of a human author, you're, as it were, trying to understand the intentions of a divine author. And you know what the Bible says? God says, "Ki lo machshevotai machshevoteichem," right? We can't read God's mind, as it were. So while we might be able to figure out a difficult passage in Shakespeare by saying, well, you know, Shakespeare lived in Stratford-on-Avon in England in this time, and we have other things that were written at the same time, so we figure that Shakespeare must have used pretty much the same English that everybody was using in those days. And since Shakespeare was married and married again, and he did this and he did that, so this is a reflection of his knowledge of this, and this is a reflection of his knowledge of that, that's a reasonably, I'm not saying that it's a simple thing to do, right? Well, put it the other way. I'm not saying it's an easy thing to do, but it's a simple thing to do. But to take a verse in the Torah and to try to figure out not just what Moses might have meant when he wrote it, but to understand what God meant when he dictated it to Moses, that, of course, is what makes it complicated and, of course, what makes it challenging. And because it's challenging, of course, that's what makes it rewarding. Chukim do not contradict reason. They may not have reasons that we can fathom, but the fact that we don't fathom the reasons doesn't make them unreasonable. It doesn't make them illogical. Maimonides was very clear about that. Maimonides said that every law in the Torah is reasonable. He did, however, distinguish between laws that he called mishpatim, for which the reasons were reasonably understandable, and laws that he called chukim, whose reasons were relatively difficult to discern. Okay. I'm sorry. If you want to try again, having trouble, Islam. First of all, the Talmud is older than Islam, and the Talmud is all dedicated to understanding the Torah. So it's not as though, in fact, it's the other way around. When Muslims started to try to figure out the Quran, they probably drew on the earlier example of Jews trying to understand the Torah in the Talmud. And there we go. Maxine, back to you if you want to give us the coming attractions.
I'm actually, I'm, yeah, Rabbi Kelman is here, so he'll go ahead.
Maxine asked if I would do it. Okay, I'm back. I'm finished. I managed to get to the last few minutes. So the coming attraction tomorrow, Mark Trencher is going to talk about the finances of Orthodoxy. That's at 11 a.m. He's from, you know, Nishma Research. The report was released, I don't know, less than 3 weeks ago. It's like the survey of a few thousand Orthodox Jews, both modern Orthodox and the Haredi, as we discussed last week a little bit, a self-definition, people define themselves. So he'll be discussing the finances, which is, I think, a fascinating topic, a sociological topic. That's tomorrow at 11 a.m. Tomorrow night, Parsha Shir, Rav Yaakov Jaffe from Maimonides, school in Boston, Maimonides Shul, the rabbi where Rav Soloveitchik, of course, served as the Rav, and it's in quite a shul. I mean, whatever. So he's now holds the pulpit that Rav Soloveitchik held, and that's tomorrow night at 8:30. Then my Parsha Shir, 9 a.m. Please go out Friday morning. And Menachem Liebtag will, I guess, finish our official fall, series on Sunday at 11:15, a couple of weeks into winter. And I'm sure you all got the email today about our 14 courses in the winter, what quote unquote is starting on Monday. And somebody was asking about Islam. I missed the earlier part of Rav Sadia Gaon, but we're beginning. Lindsay Guhartz, Dr. Lindsay Guhartz will be giving a 10-part series on Islam for Jews, what Jews should know about Islam. So a little bit, a topic I did not learn about in yeshiva, that much I can guarantee you. And I'm sure most of you didn't learn about it in your yeshiva or day school either. So that's going to begin 11 a.m. on Monday. And then we have a whole series of classes, a number beginning next week and some beginning the week after. And actually a few of them beginning only in February. So if you didn't get the email, let me know. You should have gotten the email. Everybody here in this class should be on our list, should have gotten the email already. And please invite a friend. Please come and learn. And I think we have I can't toot my own horn, but I think it's a very, there's something for everybody. I think it's lots of learning opportunities. So please do come. Please, most importantly, invite your friends. It's a new time. Invite everybody, invites one friend, then we double our attendance. So that would be amazing. So it may take you more than one invitation to get somebody to come. So anyways, we look forward to learning. Please register. As you saw, you can register with one button for all of them. Then you'll get, all the announcements like before every class. If you're just interested in one or two or three of them, whatever, you can register for those individually. But anyways, we look forward to learning with you. Okay, and thank you, Maxine, for introducing and the first part of the class. And thank you very much for all the work you do on behalf of Tormotion, putting up all these programs that we have in the background, the back end work, doing a lot of the back end work as she continues her studies at University of Toronto. So thank you. Okay. Anyways, Lila to everybody. And thank you, Dr. Sokolow. I'll have to catch the first part later on our YouTube channel or listen online so you can join in. Okay, everybody. Lila to be well. Thank you very much.